space, time, and matter. The mysterious forces of nature. What is gravity? The symbols representing all the elements around. Bright minds known as theoretical physicists. Everything falls to Earth with the same acceleration.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Howard Burton, Executive Director of Perimeter Institute, and it's my great pleasure to welcome you back again for this evening's lecture. This lecture is a little bit different. It's presented in partnership with a research cluster, Time and Universe, through the efforts of Rick Arthur, Steve Savitt, and Wayne Mervold. Some of you who have been regular participants at these events may have recognized Wayne's name. He was part of a debate on quantum theory that we had several years previously. The purpose of the cluster is to engage both physicists and philosophers in issues concerning the philosophical and physical aspects of time. And this resonates quite strongly with the sort of work, or at least an aspect of the sort of work we do at Perimeter Institute. It may come as a surprise to some of you that we involve philosophers at the Institute, and we study issues such as foundations of physics at the Institute, along with more technical scientific areas of superstring theory and quantum information theory and so forth. And this is all part of the mandate of the Institute to be exploring some of these foundational issues from a variety of different perspectives and valuing the very important and essential insight that philosophers as well as physicists give to these foundational issues. And there is no better person, in my view, who represents the amalgamation of physics and philosophy through foundational physics than Professor Harvey Brown, whom we are very fortunate to have with us this evening. Professor Brown did his undergraduate work in physics at the University of Canterbury in New Zealand before moving on for his PhD at the University of London. Following that, he took up a six-year stint as a faculty member in Brazil at the State University of São Paulo at Campinas, I believe, although I'm doubtless pronouncing that incorrectly. Following which, he became a faculty member at Oxford, at the University of Oxford, where he is presently a professor of philosophy. So it gives me great pleasure to introduce Professor Harvey Brown, who will be talking about time and motion tonight. Professor Brown.
It's a very great pleasure, and it's a very, very great privilege for me to be here today. I'd like to thank Howard Burton for his very warm welcome and generous remarks. I'd like to thank Michael Duchesne also for his role in my being here tonight. When I received the kind of invitation to speak at this venue, I suggested the title Einstein and Time, and I received a very polite but firm reply from the powers that be at the Perimeter that in 2005, which of course, as you know, was the great anniversary, the 100-year anniversary of Einstein's 1905 paper on special relativity, there had been a large number of talks on Einstein. And the impression that I got was that the Perimeter was Einstein-saturated, or something like that. Fair enough. So I thought today I would talk a little bit about time and motion in a pre-relativistic context. This is not quite true, because what I have to say today also has a lot of relevance to Einstein's special theory of relativity, but I won't discuss that per se. So I want to talk a little bit today about time and motion prior to Einstein. But let's start with a wider question. Where are we in the world? What is our place in the greater scheme of things? Here's an answer given by Carl Sagan. We live on a hunk of rock and metal that orbits a humdrum star in the obscure outskirts of an ordinary galaxy comprised of 400 billion stars in a universe of some 100 billion galaxies. It makes you feel a little bit insignificant, doesn't it? Actually, physics at the moment is a little bit ambiguous as to our significance, because you often hear physicists say that the universe was really fine-tuned for life, maybe even for us. So maybe our place in the world is not quite as marginal as it seems. But nonetheless, the message that Sagan is giving us, that we're a very small part of a vast cosmos, there was a seminal moment in the history of science that was really the beginning of the understanding of this message, and that, of course, was the Copernican Revolution. In the 15th century, Copernicus stated that it wasn't the sun that moved, but the earth. And he defended a whole new way of thinking about the solar system and our relationship with the stars. The question arises, what is the difference, say, between the Ptolemaic system, the geocentric system, the system in which the earth is at rest and the sun and the planets circle the earth, and the geocentric system? When we say that, for example, the earth is moving, what is it moving with respect to? Now, motion is always defined as a relative concept. When we say something is moving, we always mean that it's moving relative to something. Well, what is the something that it's moving relative to? Now, physicists have a rather strange language because they talk about motion relative to things like coordinate systems or frames of reference. These are rather abstract things. But when you think about a frame of reference, it's a system of spatial, say, coordinates, maybe with clocks attached to them. Why is it wrong to plunk your coordinate system on the Earth rather than on the sun? What difference does it make? Why the fuss? Why isn't it just a question of perspective? If we say that the Earth is moving, we have to ask ourselves if there's some kind of backbone to the universe relative to which we can define absolute motion. And well, what is it? Well, what was Copernicus's own answer? Copernicus chose as the backbone of the universe the sphere, what he thought was the sphere of fixed stars. So in a sense, he was inheriting almost an Aristotelian notion that the stars were embedded in a sphere, and all the fundamental motions of the world were defined with respect to this backbone of the universe. Now, just before I go on to earlier notions of the stars and motion relative to the stars, I just wanted to mention that the really shocking thing about the Copernican Revolution, in a way, was this. If you ultimately define motion relative to the fixed stars, and we are moving throughout the course of the year in an orbit around the sun, and we're moving with respect to the stars, why don't we see the phenomenon of stellar parallax? As I'm walking along on this platform, I'm looking at you, and I see your spatial arrangements changing as I walk. Of course, your relative distances aren't changing between you, but from my point of view, you are moving amongst yourselves. This is just the effect of parallax. If we're moving with respect to the stars, why don't we see a similar phenomenon with respect to the stars? Why don't we see the stars moving amongst themselves? Because they're very far away. In fact, they're enormously far away. Suddenly, the universe went through an enormous expansion. And if the stars are really that far away, maybe there are other suns. And maybe those other suns also have planets. And suddenly the universe looks very, very large, and we look a little bit like a speck. And that is a shocking thing. But is it right to define motion with respect to the stars? And has it always been that way? Well, of course not. Let's go back to Ptolemy. Ptolemy, of course, represented the highest point in the articulation of what is essentially, if you like, an Aristotelian worldview, where the Earth is at the center of the universe, and it defines the fundamental frame. Now, why was Aristotle concerned about putting the Earth at the center of the universe? Aristotle himself was reacting to a theory of motion, which goes back to the Greek atomists. And the atomists, like Democritus, felt that basically the world was just a void with atoms falling in the void. And the atoms would sometimes coalesce and form worlds, and then they would disintegrate again, and they would come back together and form worlds, and so on ad infinitum. And Aristotle asked the question, falling with respect to what? The void does not come with signposts that say up and down. What does it mean to say that the atoms were falling? And Aristotle realized that if you wanted to make sense of the notion of motion, you have to have a cosmology that has a backbone, that has some sort of structure, a timeless structure, with respect to which you can define motion. Now, it is not the case that, for Aristotle, that the Earth is necessarily at rest. What's at rest at the center of the universe? And the universe has a kind of an onion-like structure. It has layers that are spherical. The outermost layer, of course, is the layer of the is the orb of the fixed, of the stars, but there are layers. There are orbs or spheres made out of a fifth element, the quintessence, that contains the planets, for example, the moon. The natural motion, the force-free natural motion of bodies that have a preponderance of the element Earth, such as the planet Earth itself, is to move towards the center of this system. Now, wherever it was that the world was some time ago, now it's at the center. That's its natural motion. So the natural place to start in asking whether something is moving is it moving with respect to the center of the universe? And that means the Earth, because the Earth has already got there. Now, Ptolemy himself did something rather interesting. He understood the nature of time in astronomy. I don't want to say much about this now, but I'll come back to it. He understood, for example, that when you're defining a day, you should do it using the stars and not the sun. I'll come back to that later. But he also suspected, after all, if you're using the Earth and the center of this spherical universe to define the backbone, the fundamental frame of reference, then it's not so clear that the stars need to be fixed. And indeed, Ptolemy raised the question, well, could they be actually moving amongst themselves? And he started to keep records of the positions of the stars, and some centuries later, Halley in 1718 used Ptolemy's data to eventually establish the existence of stellar parallax. So for Ptolemy, there was the possibility that, from our perspective, the stars do move amongst themselves, although it wasn't established at the time. Let's step a lot further forward to Galileo. Of course, you know that Galileo was a staunch defender of Copernicanism, and it led him into a certain amount of trouble. What did Galileo mean when he said that the Earth moves? Well, Galileo famously remarked at one stage that, you know, you can't have your cake and eat it. Either it's moving or it's not moving. But with respect to what? Well, Galileo had an intuition that many of us have, that really motion is something absolute. Either something is moving or it isn't, and it's moving with respect to space. There is a problem with this position, which is that you can't do anything with it in physics. Because you can never tell whether a body is moving with respect to space or not, because space doesn't have any kind of visible form that allows you to say whether the body in question is moving or not. But we often have a very deep instinct that things are moving because they're moving with respect to space, but this is not an operational notion and it won't do in physics. Galileo himself introduced a very strange theory of the tides because he thought you could compound the absolute motion of the tides sitting on the surface of the Earth with their annual motion around the sun, and at times those motions would add and at times they would subtract, and you would create a tidal motion on the surface of the Earth, and this is a terrible theory. It doesn't work at all. And interestingly, nowadays it's removed, it's given up because it violates the Galilean principle of relativity. Maybe I'll come back to that later. Of course, in 1633, Galileo was condemned by the Inquisition of the Holy Roman Church. This was not one of the finest moments in the history of the Catholic Church, but there is an irony here. Because in condemning Galileo for defending the motion of the Earth, it's not really clear what the issue was. What do you mean by motion? Had this been established? Is it motion with respect to the stars or not? What does it mean to say that the earth moves rather than the sun? There was a fundamental ambiguity here. But the other aspect of the irony was Galileo's condemnation indirectly led to a whole new way of understanding motion, which resulted basically in Newton. And I want to say a little bit about that story in the following part of the talk. There's a very nice passage in the wonderful book by Julian Barber, 1989, Absolute or Relative Motion, The Discovery of Dynamics, where he's discussing this particular moment in the history of science. Let's say it's around 1640. So it's roughly 10 years after the condemnation of Galileo. Of course, the church had its position, but the scientists, the natural philosophers of the time, had a different position. The lesson of Copernicanism was beginning to sink in. The great cosmic debate had raged for a century. Just when it appeared to be resolved in favor of Copernicus and Galileo, yes, the earth does move, Descartes, the great French natural philosopher, put the whole debate in a totally different perspective. From now on, the question was no longer, does she move or does she not? It was transformed into, what is motion? So what was the role of Descartes in this transformation? Descartes was one of the great pioneers of the mechanical philosophy. He believed that the world was basically made of matter and motion. He questioned whether the stars themselves had fixed spatial relations between them. That's to say, he believed that the stars themselves may be moving relative to each other. He also proposed the modern principle of inertia, which I'll come to in a moment. Galileo had the idea that if you have a body that hugs the surface of the earth and you put it into motion and let it run freely without friction, it will hug the surface of the earth indefinitely. Its inertia will take it in indefinite motion. But this was not the modern notion of inertia, because it was a motion that was hugging the surface of the earth. It was, as it were, horizontal motion. Descartes had the idea that if you have a force-free body, a body in which no agent is acting on it, and there's no friction, for example, the body will move in a straight line at a uniform speed forever in a straight line, not just hugging the surface of the earth. But the question that Descartes really raised was, what do we mean by motion in the first place? And there was a fundamental transformation that occurred between his book called The World, which was he was about to publish in 1632, 1 year before Galileo's condemnation. The condemnation of Galileo stopped Descartes from publishing this work because it contained a straightforward defense of Copernicanism that was very much like Galileo's. Very much like Galileo's. Somehow or other, he had to find a way of understanding or selling the Copernican system in a fashion that would be acceptable by the church authorities. And he found a way. And this was published in the Principles of Philosophy of 1644, and it was this way that Newton reacted to so violently. Let me go back to the law of inertia. Most of you will be very familiar with this law. We now refer to this as the first law of Newtonian mechanics, Newton's first law. Any body that is free from the action of external action of forces is going to move in a straight line at a uniform speed. That's what the law says in its usual format. Here's what the way Descartes put it. Descartes split it into two aspects, one the straight line aspect and one the uniform speed aspect. And this is in the Principles of Philosophy of 1644, but he already had this law in his earlier work. The first of these laws of nature is that each thing always remains in the same state insofar as it can and never changes except as a result of external causes. Thus, if a particular piece of matter is at rest, we hold that it will never begin to move unless pushed into motion by some cause. That seems reasonable, doesn't it? And if it moves, there is equally no reason for thinking it will ever lose its motion of its own accord and without being checked by something else. So this is like a principle of conservation of motion. Given that nothing is acting on the system, why should its motion increase or dwindle? The second law, which is now normally incorporated into Newton's first law, is that every piece of matter considered in itself always tends to continue moving, not in an oblique path, but only in a straight line. And again, you might think this is very natural, because if it starts moving in a straight line and there's nothing acting on it, why doesn't it stay in the straight line? This is an early formulation of the law due to Newton. Of course, Newton really, I think he learned this law by reading Descartes' work. A quantity will always move on its same straight line, not changing the determination or celerity of its motion, unless some external cause divert it. When we say that a force-free body is moving inertially, or moving in a straight line at uniform speed, with respect to what? Remember I said that motion is something relative. We have to specify what the motion is moving with respect to. Nowadays, physicists say, well, we mean moving with respect to inertial frames of reference. And what are they? Inertial frames of reference are coordinate systems relative to which force-free bodies move inertially. There's another problem that arises here, which is, what do we mean by a force-free body? We better not say that a force-free body is a body that moves inertially. You can see that although there's a prima facie plausibility about the first law of motion, we have to be very careful as to how we're going to deal with it. And I'll come back to that later. Now I want to talk about Descartes on motion and the effect of the Inquisition, the condemnation by the Inquisition of Galileo. Descartes at one stage talked about a sailor on a ship who was carrying a clock. And the clock had moving wheels inside its casement, external casement. And Descartes said, what is the motion of those wheels? Well, the wheels are moving with respect to the casement, the walls of the clock. But the walls of the clock are moving with respect to the ship because the sailor's moving along the ship. And the ship is moving with respect to the sea because the ship is moving. But the sea itself is moving with respect to the shore. And the shore itself is moving because of the motion of the earth, and then there's a compounded motion of the earth around the sun. And where do you stop? What is the true motion of the wheels in the clock? This is a little bit like postmodernism gone mad. In order to determine external place or situation, if we're going to define motion, we have to define an external place or a situation or a backbone. We must take into account some other bodies which we consider to be motionless, some fixed background. These other bodies are forming a kind of a fixed frame. And depending on which bodies we consider, we can say that the same thing simultaneously changes and does not change its place. Finally, if we think that no truly motionless points of this kind are found in the universe, and after all, Descartes was questioning whether the stars themselves were really fixed. Descartes was raising the possibility that the stars themselves move amongst themselves. They're simply things like distant suns. Then from that, we shall conclude that nothing has an enduring place except insofar as its place is determined in our minds. And the whole thing becomes what might be called an academic exercise. How do you get out of this conundrum? How do you establish a notion of true motion? Now, Descartes introduced the idea of a distinction between what he called vulgar motion and true philosophical motion. Now, vulgar motion, we might say, well, for example, I'm moving on this platform, and you might say, vulgar, in some vulgar sense, I'm moving, but I haven't established whether I'm really moving. I mean, it may well be that I'm at rest and this whole building is moving or something. Who knows? Try to imagine how you're going to get out of this conundrum. If you think of the wheels in the clock, there is one natural thing to say. I'm not saying it's plausible, but there's one natural way of breaking down this difficulty. You say, motion is defined with respect to the closest bodies. Otherwise, there's just too many other bodies. Take the closest ones. Take the ones that are contiguous to the body, and that means the casement of the clock. Is this going to be useful? We'll see. But it comes in very handy. So Descartes says the following: if we consider what we should understand by motion, not in common or vulgar usage, but in accordance with the truth of the matter, and if our aim is to assign a determinate nature to it, we may say that motion is the transfer of one piece of matter or one body from the vicinity of other bodies which are in immediate contact with it and which are regarded as being at rest to the vicinity of other bodies. So this was his solution. Now, there is something natural about it because, as I said before, there's something unique about the bodies that are closest to the body that we're interested in. We're going to come to Newton in a minute, but I can't resist anticipating one of Newton's arguments. Newton said, suppose I put a piece of lead in a box, or suppose I have a wooden box and I throw it against the wall, and I see what kind of damage it does to the wall. Then I put some lead inside a similar box, and I throw that against the wall, and I see what kind of damage that does. Now, we're going to expect to see a great deal more damage in the second case, but the lead wasn't moving. Because it wasn't moving with respect to the immediately contiguous body. Why did Descartes choose the solution? Because Descartes believed that the Earth, in its motion around the sun, was being carried along by a huge vortex, a fluid vortex. There's a huge plenum of particles that permeates the universe. These particles are in collective motion. There's a kind of a vortex of motion in the solar system, and it carries the planets around the sun. Is the Earth moving or not? Well, it depends on the motion of the vortex particles closest to the Earth. And if you can convince yourself that that film of particles around the surface of the Earth is at rest with respect to the Earth, then philosophically the Earth does not move. Clever? It's arguable. Plausible? Hardly. Was Descartes doing this out of convenience or out of piety? I leave that question to the historians. But now we come to Newton. Because Newton could see through this artifice better than anybody else. Because Newton could see that if you're prepared to accept, for the sake of argument, the Cartesian distinction between vulgar motion and true philosophical motion, you will never be able to understand the law of inertia. Why is that? Think again of the Earth moving around the sun. Now, it's a little bit like, well, since it's got circular motion or near circular motion around the sun, there's going to be a centrifugal effect. It's going to have a tendency to recede. Unless it's pulled back, there'll be a tendency for the Earth to recede from the sun. In exactly the same way as that if I have a piece of stone on the end of a string and I'm wearing it around, if I cut the string, the stone will shoot off tangentially. That's just the centrifugal effect. And by the way, what is that due to? Inertia. That's a consequence of the principle of inertia. It doesn't require external forces. Now, Descartes admitted that the Earth had a tendency to recede from the sun, which means that his principle of inertia couldn't have been defined by using true philosophical motion, because the Earth doesn't move. So said Newton, I will venture to dispose of his fictions. For he says that properly and speaking properly and according to philosophical sense, the Earth and the other planets do not move. Yet later he attributes to the Earth and planets a tendency to recede from the sun as from a center about which they are revolved. What then? Is this tendency to be derived from the, according to Descartes, true and philosophical rest of the planets, or rather from their common and non-philosophical motion? And then Newton makes a remark that really goes to the heart of the matter. I say, thence it follows, if you give up the Cartesian notion of philosophical motion as really just being an artifice, as something that's really not in the least bit plausible, as a fix, then you're left simply with the notion of relative motion. And if all the bodies in the universe partake of relative motion, there's no fixed background, and you really can't define motion in any satisfactory way at all. I say thence it follows that a moving body has no determinate velocity and no definite line in which it moves. How do you establish that it travels in a straight line? Straight lines are not written in empty space. Have you ever bumped into one? And what is worse, that the velocity of a body moving without resistance cannot be said to be uniform. Because again, what do you mean by motion? And in particular, what do you mean by uniform motion? Nor the straight line in which its motion is accomplished. So then Newton reaches a very extraordinary conclusion. It is necessary that the definition of places and hence of local motion, he just means motion, be referred to some motionless thing such as extension alone or space insofar as it is seen to be truly distinct from bodies. So we have to give up the idea that bodies form some kind of backbone to the universe, some select group of bodies, because they may all be moving in relation to each other. And now we have to say that somehow or other motion is defined with respect to absolute space. And so this is the beginning. This, by the way, was all done in work nearly 20 years before he published his great work, The Principia. And this kind of analysis appears in a document, in a paper that Descartes wrote, which began with the words De Gravitatione, about gravity, which was only discovered in the middle of the 20th century. So this is the argument for absolute space. If you define motion, and in particular the inertial motion, motion involved in the first law, the law of inertia, with respect to background bodies that form some sort of backbone to the universe, it'll be impossible if the bodies move amongst themselves, and therefore the notion of motion collapses. So you've got to appeal in the definition of motion to something that's not defined by bodies, and that's absolute space. And now, of course, you have a conundrum all over again. You don't see absolute space. It does not fall under our senses. So how do you know empirically when a body is moving or not? And in particular, how do you test the first law of motion? So we're not out of the woods yet. In order to see some way of getting out of this difficulty, let's take a quick look at what Newton means by time. Because after all, in the first law of motion, we say that a body is moving uniformly, which means at a constant speed, equal distances and equal times. Now the question is, what does that time mean? Don't we normally measure time using clocks? What is the clock that Newton's referring to? Where is the cosmic ticking that allows us to say of a given motion that is uniform? Now, of course, for Newton, there was a kind of invisible background river of time which was flowing independently of all bodies, absolute, true, and mathematical time of itself and from its own nature flows equably without relation to anything external, and by another name is called duration. It's a metric of time that exists in the background, but it's invisible. But actually, that's not going to be any good for doing physics. It's not something you can get your fingers on. Now, you can get your fingers on clocks. You can get your hands on clocks. And there's a long history of clock-making technology. But Newton says something very, very significant in the beginning of the Principia, the famous scholium to the Principia. It may be, he says, that there is no such thing as an equable motion, whereby time might be accurately measured. Now, why does he say something like this? Imagine a world that just had Newtonian bodies that were moving with no forces between them. So they were all moving independently. They were free bodies. And imagine, according to Newton, they're all moving uniformly in straight lines at uniform speeds. You say, well, with respect to what clock? And Newton would say, well, it's no good appealing to some clock outside the universe. The whole universe just is the particles. Take one of them arbitrarily. Now, suppose that you know what you mean by distance. That's a big if. But just suppose, for the sake of argument, we know what we mean by distance. Take that one body and define it as a clock. Say, it moves equal distances and equal times. It defines the clock. Now there's a non-trivial question as to whether or not all the other bodies are going to move uniformly with respect to that standard. And if the first law of motion is true, they will. So you don't look to find time from something outside the system. You look to find a notion of duration, of a metric of time, from within. You choose one of the bodies as a clock. But here's the rub. We don't live in such a universe. We live in a much more interesting universe where bodies act on each other. There are forces in Newtonian dynamics. And the forces have a tendency, that's exactly what they're there for, to pull bodies off their inertial motions. Now, you might say, well, let's think about the nature of the forces. Suppose the forces, for example, between bodies are something like gravitational forces, they're like action at a distance, and they fall off with distance. They never go away completely. So if I take an isolated body that's far enough away, I can use it as a clock. But it's only approximate. It's only approximate. There may be, says Newton, no such thing as an equable motion. There may be no such thing as an equable motion. In other words, Newton is warning us not to define time in terms of the behavior of any bodies or any clocks that we might construct. And I want now to go on to a theme that's come up over and over again in the history of modern physics, which is maybe what might be called the problem of the standard of time. At the end of the 19th century, it's rather remarkable to see a number of thinkers, a number of physicists who are grappling with the problem of time, all coming independently to the same conclusion. George Francis Fitzgerald, who's famous in the history of special relativity for the so-called Fitzgerald-Lorentz contraction effect, was one of them. Henri Poincaré, the great French polymath, who was also very important in the history, well, he was one of the greatest mathematicians of his age, but did a great deal of, he did many, many things in physics and was one of the trailblazers for relativity theory. A number of these people ended up saying roughly the same thing. But here's the problem. When Fitzgerald is writing about time, he says, when I go to try to find, for example, an ultimate standard of duration, of time, I go to the astronomers. The astronomers tell me, because the best clock that we have in the universe is the rotation of the Earth. There was no other clock at the end of the 19th century that came close to being as accurate as the rotation of the Earth. That's why you go to the astronomers. There is every reason for assuming that the Earth rotates on its axis more uniformly than any clock we can construct. That's our standard of time, our standard of duration. But we know that the rotation rate is changing. And how do we know that? Well, because the Earth is not a rigid body. There are oceans on the Earth. They suffer tidal effects due to the gravitational pull of other celestial bodies. There are frictional forces. There is a long-term tendency for the Earth to slow down. By the way, it's much more complicated. We know now that it's so complicated we can't even predict it. And in the last decade, the Earth has started to speed up again. Now, how can it be that we define a standard of time? How can it be that we define a standard of time, and yet we know it's not a standard? How can that be? Well, what we say is, of course, we have to find a more ultimate standard of time, but what is it? Now, I promised I wouldn't say anything about Einstein, but I can't keep it. How can you talk about time and motion without saying something about Einstein? But I'm only going to say of something very brief. What is duration? Well, what you might say is duration is defined by ideal clocks. That's exactly what he said in his 1905 paper. Time is what is measured by ideal ticking clocks. But of course, that begs the question, what is an ideal clock? And Einstein was curiously silent about this issue. And then in 1910, he wrote the following remark: by a clock, we understand anything characterized by a phenomenon passing periodically through identical phases, so that we must assume by virtue of the principle of sufficient reason that all that happens in a given period is identical with all that happens in an arbitrary period. So an ideal clock ticks perfectly because I think it does. Or I have good reason to think it does. Or I have no good reason to think it doesn't. Well, it's not that the idea is silly, it's just that it's not fully explained. On the other hand, you have a notion that's kind of the reverse, which is ideal clocks are defined by duration. Now, remember, Newton said, don't define time in terms of clocks because there may be no such thing as equable motions. This was picked up by Fitzgerald, by Poincaré, by a prominent engineer called Buckingham in 1912, Julian Barber in his books, in particular in his book On the End of Time. A number of people have stressed this point. Ideal clocks are defined by duration, not the other way around. But of course, that begs the question, what is duration? Well, what is it? It can only be one thing. It's the parameter that appears in the basic equations of physics that govern the most fundamental interactions that makes them take their simplest form. In other words, it's built into the physics. It's built into the fundamental equations of physics. That's what time ultimately is. Now, whether or not you can build a clock that marches in step with that parameter that appears in our equations is another matter. And in general, you can't, because you can never totally isolate a clock. And it'll be perturbed by influences coming from outside. And in fact, there may well be no ideal clock except for the whole universe. But you see the distinction here. We're really going back to Newton's intuition that clocks are not the ultimate thing. Time is the ultimate thing, and clocks are designed to march in step with this time. But it's the time that appears in the fundamental equations. That's what time is. That's what the notion of duration. Now I'm coming close to the end of the story. Let's go back to the question of the principle of inertia again. Bodies move in straight lines at uniform speeds if no forces are acting on them. We haven't quite said what we mean by that yet. In fact, Arthur Eddington, the famous British physicist who gave the first test using solar eclipses of Einstein's general theory of relativity in 1919, this is the thing that shot Einstein into world fame, once said that the best way to state the first law of motion is force-free bodies move in straight line and straight lines in uniform speeds, except insofar as they don't. Well, nowadays we say an inertial frame is one relative to which the Descartes-Newton law of inertia holds, and of course, those are the frames relative to which we define the first law of motion, and we seem to have the circle that I mentioned before. We seem to be in a kind of a circle. But there's a simple way out of this. There's a simple way out of it. Okay, it is true that an inertial frame of reference is a coordinate system. It's a perspective on the world. It may not be embodied by any sort of set of given bodies, but it's a perspective on the world relative to which force-free bodies, and we have to be able to say, roughly speaking, what we mean by that without begging the question. Force-free bodies move inertially. Good. Do they exist? If you claim that at least one exists, you're saying something empirical. I know you can define them, and definitions don't lead to anything. Definitions don't have any empirical content. But to claim that an inertial frame exists is a very highly non-trivial claim. But what is it? It's a shorthand way of saying that if you take all the force-free bodies in the universe, and I mean all of them, you can find a perspective relative to which they move, first of all, in straight lines. Who ordered that? Now remember, force-free bodies are not interacting amongst themselves. They're oblivious one to another. There must be some amazing conspiracy that's very non-local and holistic that determines that all these force-free bodies that have no inkling of their brothers and sisters, you can find a perspective, a frame of reference relative to which they all move in the same straight lines. And furthermore, they move at uniform speeds as defined by, say, taking one of them and saying that it measures equal distances and equal times. And this is an amazing conspiracy of nature. It's not just not obvious, it's almost unbelievable. Something that at first sight seems so natural is almost unbelievable because it represents an extraordinary conspiracy in nature. So the point that I'm saying here, the punchline here is how to avoid the circularity, make the law of inertia an existence claim. There exists at least one inertial frame, and that is shorthand for saying something about the way force-free bodies organize themselves in space. And I mean all force-free bodies in the universe. If that is a meaningful notion, and it is, well, there are caveats, which I don't have time to go into. But it is essentially a meaningful notion. It's essentially the notion that physicists use in Newtonian mechanics. Then we have a backbone of the universe. We have the inertial frames. And therefore, if we ask, does the Earth move or does it not? Well, at least we have something by way of an answer. Does it move with respect to inertial frames? That's not the whole story. And I'm sure many of you know exactly why that is. Because we also have a principle of relativity. This wasn't invented by Einstein. It goes all the way back to Copernicus, probably, if not earlier. And it was famously discussed by Galileo. And it's simply the claim that if you do an experiment and you're at rest with respect to an inertial frame, and you repeat the experiment when you're in uniform motion with respect to that inertial frame, you get the same results. And that's another way of saying you will never be able to detect your motion with respect to an inertial frame if you're moving inertially. Shucks. But one thing that you can say is whether or not you're accelerating with respect to an inertial frame, and that is categorical. So the question now is, does the Earth accelerate with respect to an inertial frame? And according to our best understanding of the solar system, given Newtonian gravity, the answer is yes, because it's being acted upon by the force of gravity associated with all the other bodies in the solar system, and in particular the sun. But notice that in coming back to this question, does the Earth move or does it not? This key moment in the history of science, we needed to know what motion was, and the answer is given by appealing to inertial frames, which post-date Galileo's Inquisition. Now, there are many caveats here. Well, not many, but the biggest one, of course, is Einstein. But I shall say nothing. Thank you very much.
I guess the first comment I'd like to make is that I had no idea this institute is responsible for making Einstein a four-letter word. And perhaps the second comment that I have is, listening to your talk, it occurred to me that a little over 2,400 years ago, this man Socrates was put to death for a wide variety of reasons, but ostensibly one of the reasons was that he was bamboozling the citizenry of Athens into such a state that they thought that up was down and down was up and so forth. And it's my sense that there are a great many members of the audience this evening that are going to leave in a remarkably disconsolate state because they thought they understood what motion was and they thought they understood what time was and space was. And now they're going to have second thoughts. So be that on your head. I suppose you can deal with that.
Well, when I was preparing this talk, I thought to myself, I don't know how much of this will come across as comprehensible. But I felt that the talk would be successful if I raised a doubt in your minds as to what you mean by motion, and in particular, what you mean by the Copernican Revolution. So I don't know whether that was successful.
Well, let's see. Let's open up the floor to questions and see if anybody has any particular questions or concern, or you're all satisfied? You now have a complete understanding of, yes, there seems to be a question right there from the gentleman in the middle.
Yeah, I was just wondering, is there such a thing as real time, or is it just perceptions of time as opposed to a real time? Because,
well,
you know, we all perceive it differently according to how long we've been here.
I'm going to couch my answer in the context of Newtonian mechanics, because that's what basically the whole talk was about. I mean, if one goes then into relativity, things become a bit more complicated, but not necessarily hugely so. Yes, there is time, because within Newtonian mechanics, there is a uniquely preferred duration. Poincaré famously remarked that actually this is a sort of a convention, because we could take that parameter in Newtonian mechanics, replace it by something more complicated. In turn, that would complicate the laws of physics, but you wouldn't go to jail. That's to say, you wouldn't actually make any predictive errors. It's just that your calculations would become correspondingly complicated, because you'd have to compensate in your equations for the introduction of a non-standard temporal parameter. But the fact of the matter is, there is one natural temporal parameter in Newtonian mechanics, and it does define duration. And we build clocks, mechanical clocks, that fit, that march in step as far as possible with that time. Now, this is not trivial. Maybe I could just say, to see that this is highly non-trivial, think of the laws of thermodynamics, classical thermodynamics. Suppose we lived in a world, this is very fanciful, I'm not really sure it entirely makes sense, but suppose that we lived in a world where all the knowledge of the world we had was associated with the laws of thermodynamics, which are essentially saying things like, there does not exist any perpetual motion machine of this kind or that kind. And from this we derive the notions of entropy, and we can show that entropy for systems increases. We can define laws that govern, for example, the efficiency of heat engines. But notice that in this theory, there is no equation that has time in it. There is no notion of duration in thermodynamics. There is no notion of a clock. Now, we happen to live in a world where there is a notion of time, of duration, and it's the same notion that's picked out whether you appeal to electromagnetic forces, gravitational forces, the strong forces that hold the nucleus together, and so on. And this is a very, very remarkable thing. Why should all these different forces be expressed by fundamental equations that all pick out the same time? I'm hoping somebody one day will explain that to me.
I think there's a question right over here.
My name's Alex Duthie. I find your talk very good philosophically and academically. And when we talk about time and motion and inertia and how much you infer that we don't know about it, I think about the engineers in Houston who appear to know where Mars is, appear to know where all the planets are. They appear to know how to shoot a rocket up and nearly precisely tell you when it's going to reach places like Venus in 3 or 4 years. So we must know something about time and motion. It's just a comment, I guess.
Thank you very much. I'm very glad that somebody has finally dragged us down to Earth. Of course we do. We know an enormous amount. And when planetary scientists and rocket engineers and all the rest of it, I mean, people who actually plot these trajectories for these amazing probes, planetary probes, what are they using? They're using essentially Newtonian mechanics and the Newtonian theory of gravity. When I say we don't know where we are, we don't know, as it were, where the totality of things are sitting in space, because it doesn't really mean anything. But we know where we are in relation to other bodies. We know what forces it's going to take to launch something, to act against the gravitational pull of the Earth, to emerge from the gravitational pull, to be pointed in the right direction so that eventually it coincides with the very tiny atmosphere of a planet or something, where it actually moves into the planet. Of course, all these things we know, and if we didn't, we couldn't do these things. But the astronomers, all the way back to the ancient Greeks, the Babylonians were able to predict solar eclipses. There were rules of the game, and the astronomers knew very well how to define time in terms of, say, the rotation of the Earth rather than the motion of the sun. These things were well understood. But it's a very curious thing that when we try to understand exactly how to get a grip on the fecundity, I mean, on the efficacy of Newton's laws of motion and precisely what they mean conceptually, as opposed to applying them, it's surprisingly difficult. The notion of an inertial frame was being used effectively by astronomers for centuries, but was only really properly defined conceptually at the end of the 19th century.
We have time for one more question, and I believe there's somebody, right over there, right up there in the white shirt.
In a universe where there's the existence of at least one inertial frame and you have force-free bodies defined as all being in straight lines, the question I have is, does this then imply that there is a single point in the universe from which you could say that is an absolute point, if there was a body there and it remained there, that it would be at absolute rest? Or is this sort of a blanket statement where any object at rest in relation to those force-free bodies would be at absolute rest?
Well, if there was an isolated body in the universe, then that body would either stay at rest with respect to an inertial frame or move uniformly. I mean, that's, again, how we define the inertial frame. But there don't exist such bodies. There exist approximations to them, but they don't exist any literally force-free bodies. But suppose we put a body as far away as we like, we remove it as much as we possibly can from the gravitational pull of other bodies. So it's to a very good approximation force-free. Or we might think, for example, of a surface where we have a body that's constrained on the surface, say, by gravity, something like an ice hockey rink, where we can lower the friction, let's say, almost without limit. Then a body that's moving on that surface will also move inertially, assuming that the rink is at rest with respect to an inertial frame. What we can't say is that it's absolutely at rest, because of the relativity principle. We can't say that. But we can say that it's moving inertially with respect to any particular inertial frame. But we can't say that it's absolutely at rest, because the relativity principle rules that out. I'm not sure I answered that very well, but I take your point.
Well, what I can say, and absolutely, is that we very much enjoyed your talk. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed. I appreciate that. Thank you.